Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. On Monday, police in Nashville, Tennessee, apprehended the man suspected of killing four people and wounding four others in a Waffle House restaurant. Witnesses say Travis Reinking walked up to the Murfreesboro Pike Waffle House in Antioch, Tennessee, just outside of Nashville, early on Sunday morning and started firing. When he tried to reload, a customer named James Shaw Jr. jumped up and wrestled the AR-15 assault rifle out of Travis Reinking's hands, and then Reinking fled into the dark. That kicked off a manhunt for Travis Reinking that lasted 34 hours, and as more of his backstory is revealed now, more questions arise about his access to weapons. We'll come back to that in just a moment, but first let's go to Dave Boucher. He's investigative reporter for the Tennessean who joins me now from Nashville. Dave, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
Well, Dave, bring us up to date on the latest on Travis Reinking's apprehension. How was he caught? What happened yesterday?
So yesterday afternoon at roughly 1 p.m. Central Time Monday, a call came in from a construction crew that was working in the vicinity of the Waffle House where the attack actually occurred early Sunday. A call came in. Someone said that they saw a man who looked like he was a little bit confused and nervous. Police arrived within minutes of the call. They entered into a wooded area near the construction site. And a detective saw a man who met Reinking's description. They told him to lay down, extend his hands, and they arrested him.
And you mentioned this was close to the Waffle House where the shooting occurred over the weekend.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the manhunt lasted 34 hours, but he was actually captured less than 2 miles away from where it started. Keep in mind that for almost all of that 34 hours, there were canine units and helicopters and law enforcement from local, state, and national agencies kind of scouring the area, looking for a man who had been described as being naked when he left the Waffle House and having only wearing pants when he was sighted later Sunday morning.
So, Dave, what about the community around this Waffle House? Obviously a huge tragedy and a major shock. And then 36 hours or so, or at least a day of what I imagine would be just nerve-wracking terror while the alleged assailant is still at large. How are people feeling now?
Yeah, I think that the way that we've described it is that the community is kind of transitioning from, as you said, terror and nerves. You know, schools were placed on lockdown. Some parents kept their kids at home. People in the neighborhood of the Waffle House were told to kind of stay inside and lock their doors. And so now that this suspect has been captured, people are starting to transition into more of a grief mode. There are four people who were killed in the Waffle House, all of them in their 20s. And so people are starting to sort of move into, you know, coping with a local tragedy.
Dave, we're going to talk in just a minute about Travis Reinking's behavioral past, his apparent history with mental health troubles, and also about his guns and how his guns were taken away in the state of Illinois. Is anyone in Tennessee talking about why Travis Reinking still had guns or at least didn't have his past known to authorities once he came to Tennessee?
Absolutely. That is something that I think is probably the largest question that remains, apart from motive, of course, in this investigation. As news came out yesterday about how he got his weapons and how, as you noted, Illinois tried to take those weapons away, legislators and local law enforcement started to look at how he was allowed to have those weapons. Two congressmen here from Tennessee, two Democrats, along with Democrats in the state Senate, have proposed or called for legislation to close what they're calling a loophole that allowed someone to have weapons here in Tennessee, even though that person was barred from having weapons in another state. Now, this week is supposed to be the last week of the legislative session in Tennessee, so the chances of anything happening legislatively this year are pretty slim. But yes, there are lawmakers talking about closing what they're calling a loophole in state gun law.
Dave Boucher, investigative reporter for the Tennessean from Nashville. Dave, we appreciate it.
Sure, thank you.
Let's turn now to the question of how and why Travis Reinking was able to have guns at all. Reinking had a long history of troubling behaviors, and authorities in Illinois forced him to surrender his weapons after he was arrested for trespassing at the White House back in July. But under Illinois law, Travis Reinking's father took custody of his son's firearms, and then, according to reports, gave them right back to his son. James Burnett is editorial director at The Trace, and he says with all the talk about gun ownership and safety, laws and procedures around gun surrender vary between the states and the federal government, and even between the states themselves. And that can throw up huge barriers to enforcement.
So the big picture here is that the federal law sets a bunch of standards, about 12 broad categories of persons who are prohibited from owning weapons. But there is no mechanism in federal law for removing guns who become prohibited after they legally acquire them. So that is left to the states. And there we fall into a patchwork of laws and systems. In Illinois, where Reinking lived at the time, that's a state where you have to have a permit to own a gun in the first case. And as you were saying, after the incident at the White House, the FBI asked state authorities to revoke his permit, and they did. But under Illinois law, once your permit is revoked, you have the option to transfer your guns to a lawful owner. You don't have to turn them over to law enforcement. And there's versions of that elsewhere, too. Sometimes the state law will say you have to sell the gun and provide receipts. But generally speaking, there's no federal mechanism for law enforcement, for the government, to take guns from someone who has become prohibited after lawfully acquiring them.
So you're describing a situation where federal law enforcement authorities, the FBI in this case, even with the law on their side, say, we don't want this guy to have access to the guns that he owns, and then essentially has to ask his home state of Illinois if and how they can accomplish that.
Right. And in some ways, their hand is stronger in that he is in Illinois, right? So if you look at the gunman's history in this case, there is this history of erratic behavior, but none of it rises to the level that would prohibit him from gun ownership. And there's some indication that he was seen for psychiatric evaluation, but that was voluntary. He was not involuntarily committed to a psychiatric hospital. And that's the criteria. You have to be involuntarily admitted or otherwise adjudicated mentally unfit by a court or commission or other authority. So you can have this history of troubling behavior, but none of it rises to that level of the mental health prohibitor under federal law. And separately, even the incident at the White House where he is arrested on a misdemeanor for unlawful entry, he enters a restricted zone. He comes back to Illinois. He does his community service, and prosecutors drop that case. It was a misdemeanor in any event. Under federal law, it's a misdemeanor that calls for 2 years of imprisonment or a felony. Those are the criteria. So that infraction itself probably doesn't prohibit him from gun ownership. So yes, federal authorities, what they can use and do use is they say, well, actually, in Illinois, you have to have a permit. And that's rare to own a gun in the first place. And we can use that mechanism. We can ask the state to revoke the permit. And then they do. But then we fall to the other side of the coin is, well, what happens to the guns themselves? Who takes custody? And again, in Illinois, there's a provision that allows you to transfer it to someone who has the permit. And in fact, you can live with the person who you transfer it to. There's no requirement that the person to whom the guns are transferred locks them up, keeps them safely stored. So there are gaps, obviously, in that relinquishment law. And the timeline here, I don't know that the timeline in this case has been nailed down definitively, but in some reports indicate that his father transferred the guns back to him after he moves to Tennessee, which does not require the permit to own the guns in the first place. And again, because his history doesn't rise to the level of prohibiting him from gun ownership, it seems he may be allowed to legally own those guns in Tennessee, even though he wasn't able to own them in Illinois.
Right. So let's talk about that interstate patchwork, because that seems really important here. I mean, you described Illinois, which has relatively strict rules and laws. You have to have a permit to own a gun. So the FBI was able to get Illinois authorities to remove Travis Reinking's guns. He moves to Tennessee, another state where the laws are much more lax. And also, do Tennessee authorities even have any way of knowing that he had his gun privileges revoked in Illinois in the first place?
To my knowledge, they wouldn't have known that. And if you go back to the big picture, there is, by federal law, no federal registry, no list of gun owners and the guns they own. And by extension, there's no list of people who have had their gun ownership rights revoked because of some history of conduct or mental illness. And so there wouldn't be a way to know that.
Well, James, this entire incident and what we're talking about, the chain of custody, essentially, of Travis Reinking's guns, has raised a conversation about red flag laws when it comes to firearms. What are red flag laws? How do they work?
So a red flag law allows law enforcement, or in some cases, family members in some states, to see that red flag and to petition a court to have a person's guns removed. And so there the mechanism is that the guns will be taken away, due process is then followed so that there's a subsequent hearing where the court decides that, in fact, that the red flag law, that the restraining order in this case was appropriate, and the guns should be removed. And when you're subject to that restraining order, you can't own guns and you can't purchase new ones. And that's what red flags are meant to do, is to provide this mechanism for taking guns away from people who emerge as high risk in a very specific way, but have not committed the sort of offense that would prohibit them under the existing federal law.
Well, James, let's end back in Illinois where we began, where Travis Ryan King was living with his father, had his guns transferred to his father's custody. And now a lot of people are asking if Travis Ryan King's father might be subject to charges himself for those guns winding up right back in Travis's hands. Could he be?
Well, that is something that authorities are saying that they're looking into. And I think it's always important in any situation to not speculate as members of the media when we don't have all the facts of the case. But the law does say that you cannot transfer guns to someone who is not allowed to own those guns. And so that would be an illegal transfer if it happened within the state of Illinois. But it does seem it's possible that if it happened in Tennessee, that might be an exception. And so that's what I believe law investigators are going to be sorting out, is when did the transfer take place? Where did it take place? And did it violate this Illinois law, or did it fall under an exception?
A confusing and at times it seems haphazard patchwork of laws between the federal government, the states, when it comes to gun ownership and transfer. James Burnett, editorial director at The Trace. James, thank you so much.
Thank you.